Gray Malkin Media presents Satan's Harvest by Ed and Lorraine Warren, Michael LaSalandra, Mark Miranda, Maurice Theriault, and Nancy Theriault. Read for you by Will Dameron. These are the true accounts of the paranormal investigators featured in the Conjuring films. Since the 1960s, Ed and Lorraine Warren have been the world's most renowned paranormal investigators. Lorraine is a gifted clairvoyant, while Ed is the only non-ordained demonologist recognized by the Catholic Church. Together, they have investigated thousands of hauntings in their career. 1. Police Chief Jerry Siebert wondered why he was out freezing his ass off on this bitterly cold morning, instead of being back at the station, nursing a hot cup of coffee. He was sitting behind the wheel of his cruiser, uncomfortable because he was wearing two layers of clothing, which made it hard for him to move freely. He stretched out his long legs and arched his back. The upholstery squeaked as he stretched. He thought about what it might be like in Florida this very moment. His toes were numb. His salt-stained shoes were still wet from the slush that had covered the streets of Warren, Massachusetts since the previous Tuesday. Aside from the accident reports every time somebody drove down the steep slope of Coy Hill and skidded past the stop sign at the bottom, nothing much lately had drawn the attention of Warren's tiny police force. Siebert was fairly certain that one of his men would be called to the depot, a seedy bar on Main Street, to break up a fight later that evening. The Bruins were playing, and the bar's patrons, mostly unemployed laborers and bikers, could be counted on to draw inspiration from the hockey players and try to rearrange one another's dental work. Keeping the peace in Warren was a rather predictable business. The most dangerous moments usually occurred at the annual town meeting, Siebert thought. Getting an extra $1,000 out of the tight-fisted town fathers could be a real bloodbath. Warren, population 3,800, was not the kind of town that produced a lot of exciting police work. What it did produce was plenty of small-town politics. The board of selectmen that governed the town was often composed of three local merchants, each with his own interests, personal loyalties, and enemies. Siebert thought of them as Moe, Larry, and Curly. It didn't help any that one of the chief's four patrolmen was also Curly's nephew. You give an inexperienced group of men $1 million budget to run a small town, and they'll screw it up every time, Siebert thought bitterly. The ex-Marine had been police chief for almost 5 years, and each time he was reappointed for a 1-year term, it was a battle. Siebert longed for the day when he could quit his job and hang out his shingle as a private investigator. Rousting bored teenagers out of the town square, at the complaint of the local shoe store owner, was not his idea of glamorous police work. In any case, this was not the kind of morning he wanted to spend paying a visit to Frenchie Theriault, whom Siebert suspected of being an arsonist, and who had recently taken to telling people some very tall tales. Theriault was a local tomato farmer, best known in the area for the little wooden stand that sold farm produce in the autumn months to tourists passing through, on their way to see the annual explosion of foliage in the Berkshire Mountains of western Massachusetts. Unfortunately, the man now seemed to be retailing bullshit as well, the police chief thought. Lately, Frenchie had taken to telling folks in town that his house was possessed, and that his family was being haunted by the spirit of his wife Nancy's mother. Siebert, who had his own mother-in-law, was perfectly prepared to accept the story, if Nancy Theriault's mother had been alive. But Nancy's mother had died over 15 years earlier. Siebert couldn't help smiling a little, despite his irritation, as he recalled his own report on an incident at the station house a week before. On February 24, 1985, he had written, Maurice Frenchie Theriault came into the Warren Police Department, asking that the department take custody of several rifles he owned. Asked if there was any problem, Mr. Theriault said he was seeing a psychic, and he had been informed by the psychic that he was possessed, and should bring all his firearms to the police station. Mrs. Nancy Ferriall was with her husband and informed the officers that she was the only one who could pick up any of the firearms from the police station, and not her husband. Mr. Ferriall informed us that under no circumstances was he to be given the rifles, because he might not be himself. He may look like that person, but it might not really be him. Siebert had suppressed a snort of laughter, glad enough to get the guns out of Frenchie's hands. He had duly recorded 2 Winchester rifles and a shotgun. Siebert had nothing against Frenchie. In fact, he kind of liked the little guy. Ferriall was only about 5.5 feet tall and wore a thin mustache. His face and hands were lined from a lifetime of labor, and the sockets of his eyes were deep set, giving him a tired, brooding look that put a lot of people off. But once you got to know him, Siebert thought, he was nice enough. Last Thanksgiving, Frenchie had come to the station house with turkeys for each of the officers on the force. But since then, Siebert had ticketed Frenchie twice, because his dilapidated truck, which he used to haul the tomatoes he grew, was nowhere near roadworthy. And then there were the fires in the Ferriall farmhouse. Dan Prescott, at the state fire marshal's office, suspected Frenchie had started the small blazes himself in order to get the insurance money. Siebert was inclined to agree with him. In any case, he thought, that certainly seemed more likely than Frenchie's explanation. When he'd reported them, Frenchie had said the fires were caused by mysterious forces that invaded the house and caused objects to fly around on their own. But cops don't buy supernatural excuses for suspected crimes. That's a laugh, Siebert thought. Frenchie had undoubtedly concocted this nonsense to sidetrack the arson investigation. Pretty original, though. At least Frenchie added a bit of local color to Warren. But Siebert wasn't in the mood for it today, and was none too pleased to find himself driving up to Frenchie's house. Nancy Ferriall had called the station in a panic, screaming that she needed help. She had said she was afraid, not only for herself, but also for her 3 young grandchildren, who were visiting them at the time. Siebert could only imagine what might be going on there. Rumors of weird events at the house had been circulating in the village, and were growing more and more bizarre with each retelling. Siebert had decided to take a camera with him. Maybe some photographic evidence might quash the ridiculous stories, he thought. Things had gotten to the point where Frenchie was being shunned. Siebert had been in the diner 2 weeks before when Frenchie came in and sat down for his usual mid-morning cup of coffee. The other 5 customers looked at one another and quickly got up to pay their bills. Within 2 minutes, the door had slammed shut, ringing the little brass bells that hung on the door. The diner was empty, except for the cop, the tomato farmer, and Sam Davis, the owner. It wasn't the first time Frenchie had caused a mass exodus from the diner. Davis frowned and came over to say something to Frenchie when Siebert waved him off. "Look, Frenchie, you're ruining Sam's business," Siebert had said. "You're gonna have to stop this bullshit about your house being possessed, or you're gonna have to stop coming here. You understand?" The farmer hadn't replied. He merely nodded his head and stared into his coffee cup. Siebert's recollections were interrupted when his 2-way radio crackled. "Jerry, you need any help with that domestic?" Siebert recognized the voice of Massachusetts State Trooper Colin Kearns. Trooper Kearns was assigned to the nearby Brookfield State Police Barracks, and the 2 men had a good working relationship. It was common practice for them to respond to emergency calls together. Local residents who had seen them in action often remarked on the striking physical contrast. Siebert, the tall French-Canadian, and Kearns, the tall, rangy black man. Siebert suspected this morning's call was more of Frenchie Ferriall's effort to cover up his role in the fires at his own house. But in the back of his mind, he felt a squirm of uneasiness over the wild rumors and talk of supernatural events. Although he was a skeptical and case-hardened police officer, he was also a practicing Roman Catholic. It wouldn't hurt to have a witness in addition to the camera, he convinced himself. The police chief picked up the microphone on his mobile police radio. "Yeah, Colin, come along for the ride," he said. A minute hadn't passed before he saw Kearns's blue and gray state police cruiser fall in behind him. As they approached the Theriault property, Siebert couldn't help thinking that if the farmhouse was haunted, it was certainly in the perfect spot for it. Perched on a knoll, just off quiet Brimfield Road, the house stood alone, with no other houses in sight. The bare oak trees and slate-gray clouds above lent a desolation that gave Siebert a shudder. The simple New England frame house was rickety and badly in need of repairs. Especially, Siebert thought, since the fires that had been mysteriously started in recent months. About 200 yards from the main house was a one-story greenhouse with a tin roof. 50 yards farther on was a storage shed in the shape of a huge aluminum barrel set into the ground. The fields around the house bristled with short sticks that in a couple of months would support the vines that produced Frenchie Theriault's juicy red tomatoes. Completely encircling the open fields was a thick forest of pine trees, enclosing the farm from the outside world. It saddened Siebert to see the once proud farmhouse running to ruin. But that wasn't so unusual these days in Warren. Farming just didn't support a family the way it used to, and the central Massachusetts village had seen better days. The high-tech boom that had sparked Massachusetts' economic revival, bringing new jobs and prosperity to the state, had bypassed small farming towns like Warren. Siebert had been to the house on several occasions. Frenchie Theriault had twice called the station in the middle of the night to complain of strange noises outside his house. The police chief's subsequent investigation had turned up no evidence of any noises, or of anything that might be causing them, and Siebert was inclined to think that this problem, too, was largely in Frenchie's head. Siebert's investigation hadn't reassured the farmer. He kept insisting he'd heard the noises and talked darkly of other things done to torment him. Theriault's wife, Nancy, clearly frightened, had supported her husband's story. The law officer thought she was mainly scared of what Frenchie might do to her if she didn't agree with him. Theriault did have problems, and they were not just in his head, as the police chief was about to find out. As Siebert passed the ramshackle farm stand that stood at the entrance to the Theriault driveway, he slowed to make his turn. He couldn't count the number of times he had seen Frenchie, Nancy, and one or more of her kids weighing tomatoes at the stand, most of the time for city dwellers who were just passing through and had rarely tasted a real farm-grown tomato. Those damned things in the supermarket didn't taste any more like a tomato than a baseball did, as far as Warren's chief of police was concerned. Siebert swung past the stand and pulled up near the house. Getting out of the cruiser, he buttoned the top button of his jacket against the icy air and slammed the door shut. There, he thought, another strange noise for Frenchie to complain about. Nearing the house, he heard something that made him look up toward the clouds weighing down on the farm and darkening the late morning sky. The weather vane at the top of the Theriault home was spinning wildly, yet there wasn't a hint of breeze. "That's weird. It's as if there's a hurricane blowing," Siebert thought. He heard another car pulling up on the frozen gravel driveway. Wheeling around, he let out a sigh as he recognized Trooper Kearns. For a moment, he had forgotten he was being followed.
"What do we have, Jerry?"
Kearns rolled down the window and called out.
"I don't know," Siebert replied. "Maybe Frenchie's beating his wife or something. Come on, let's go in."
The two officers made their way along the path to the darkened side entrance of the Theriault house. It was a distraught Nancy Theriault who opened the ripped screen door. She was clutching a multicolored crocheted blanket, which was wrapped around her shoulders. 43 years old, Maurice Theriault's wife was known in the town as a pleasant, quiet woman who sold tomatoes with her husband and accompanied him to St. Paul's Catholic Church when they made one of their infrequent Sunday appearances.
with cascades of curly reddish-brown hair and, in normal circumstances, a ready country-style smile. People often told her she looked like singing star Loretta Lynn.
"Yeah," Nancy would say. "She's the coal miner's daughter, and I'm the tomato farmer's wife."
Whatever he thought of Maurice, Siebert resolved to be gentle with Nancy, who was shaking uncontrollably, her face streaked with tears.
"He's in there," she cried, pointing toward the kitchen.
The officers stepped heavily in their boots down the hall. Siebert went first, with Kearns a step behind.
"Be careful,"
Nancy whispered in a frightened voice. Maurice Theriault was sitting at the kitchen table with a dazed expression on his face. Blood streaked the black and gray stubble on his chin. He looked at the two officers as if he was exhausted and surprised to see them.
"What's going on, Frenchie?" Siebert asked.
"I don't know. I don't know,"
the farmer replied, in a voice that seemed to come from far away. Nancy Theriault pointed mutely at the bathroom door, just outside the kitchen. Kearns hesitated and looked twice at Siebert, before stepping forward and spinning the well-worn glass doorknob. The door was stuck, so he gave it a kick. It groaned and flew open. For an instant, both men stood paralyzed. The black and white tile floor of the tiny, stark bathroom was smeared with blood. The old-fashioned bathtub was streaked with it. The medicine cabinet mirror was flecked with it. The bathroom even smelled of blood. Siebert instinctively reached for his gun. He was blocking the door, and Kearns wanted out of the gruesome bathroom.
"This didn't happen 'cause he cut himself shaving," Kearns muttered to Siebert.
"Nancy, what happened here?" Siebert demanded.
"I can't tell you," she choked out. "You'll think we're crazy or criminals or something. Just like when we turned in the guns."
Siebert did his best to reassure Nancy that he only wanted her statement for his report. Finally, she agreed to tell him what had happened. Maurice had gone into the bathroom after breakfast. A few minutes later, Nancy said, she became worried and knocked on the door. She heard bizarre sounds coming from the other side, and fearing for her husband, she pushed the door open. Then she had screamed. In the middle of a pool of blood, Maurice Theriault, his face contorted beyond recognition, was lying on his back in a fetal position, gyrating like a top. His tobacco-stained teeth were bared in a wolfish grimace, and his eyes were rolled back, exposing only the whites. He was emitting a mournful wail and babbling what seemed to be words, but were not in any language his wife had ever heard. Red froth bubbled from the corner of his mouth. Petrified as she was, Nancy grabbed Maurice under each arm. He seemed to weigh a ton. But she managed to drag him out of the bathroom and into the kitchen, leaving a sweep of blood on the hardwood floor of the hallway. As soon as she had touched him, Maurice calmed considerably, although he continued to mutter incomprehensible sounds.
"That's what happened," she said. "That's the honest truth."
As she was telling the officers the story, Maurice sat propped in a rusted folding chair. Although no one had noticed it at first, blood was seeping from his eyes.
"Holy shit," Kearns said,
his uniform soaked with sweat. He wiped perspiration from his upper lip and shook his head.
"You ever seen anything like that?"
Nancy Theriault, trying to control her trembling, dabbed at Maurice's eyes with a tissue, even as her own continued to stream tears. Siebert, who had gone to the sink for a glass of water, was trying to decide if he should call for an ambulance. As he turned to Maurice, the glass of water slipped from his hand and shattered on the floor. All the others, except Maurice, jumped at the sound.
"Colin, come here," said Siebert in a strangled whisper. "Look at his back."
From the rear, the blood on Maurice's t-shirt formed a pattern the two officers instantly recognized.
They looked at each other in disbelief.
Let's get his shirt off, said Siebert. With no resistance from the semi-conscious farmer, the two men peeled off his shirt and stood back. Nancy Ferriall had seen it all before, but that didn't make it any less frightening. She started to scream.
Oh, Frenchie, not again!
The two policemen didn't even hear her. They were staring at the crimson lines on Maurice's back, lines that any Christian would recognize. Lines in the sign of the cross.
Nancy, what really is going on here? Siebert demanded when she had calmed down enough to talk.
The police chief had taken Polaroid photos of the farmer's back, photos that clearly showed the marks. Siebert was a cop, and despite the weird happenings in the Ferriall home, he tried hard to think like a cop. He knew that in any crisis, a police officer has to be aware of his surroundings, the possibilities, and the probabilities. The probability was, he thought, that Nancy Ferriall had scratched her husband, or that he had fallen down and bled a lot from superficial wounds, although Siebert had yet to see any. The possibilities, on the other hand, were endless, and Siebert didn't like to think about them.
I don't know. I don't know what's going on, Nancy stammered. Strange things have been happening to Maurice. Awful things. I've been so frightened. I know you don't believe us about the sounds, but we hear them every night now. And the other day Maurice was standing there, right there where you're standing.
And she pointed at Kearns.
And suddenly he flew across the room, as if he'd been hit by a truck.
Trooper Kearns, hardened cop though he was, did a quick sidestep off the spot where Nancy and Maurice had been standing.
It was like he was a little doll and somebody had flung him against the wall, Nancy continued. Sometimes his face changes, and I don't even know who he is. Last week, he picked up our tractor by himself.
The two policemen looked at each other. The Ferriall's tractor weighed almost 2 tons. Kearns sensed that something else was bothering Nancy. Is there something you're not telling us? He asked.
You'll think I'm crazy. I don't want everyone to say I'm crazy, Nancy sobbed.
Just tell us about it, Nancy, Kearns said, putting his muscular arm around her shoulder. Nobody's going to say anything. She took a deep breath that was interrupted by little gasps from crying. It felt good to have the police here. They could protect her and the grandchildren if Maurice were to go off the deep end again. Yet she didn't know how much of the story to tell them. She didn't want to see them haul her husband, or her, off to the nut house. But she couldn't help but blurt out another incident anyway.
Well?
She said, glancing nervously at Maurice.
Last week, I saw 2 of him.
What?
2 Maurices.
What do you mean? He looked different?
No. There were 2 of him. I saw them. There's a word for it. Doppel something.
Kearns sighed. What with bleeding eyes, crosses, unknown languages, and double apparitions, it was turning into quite a morning. He was not looking forward to writing the report on this one. While Maurice sat staring into space, almost as if he wasn't there, the two cops sat down at the kitchen table and took notes while Nancy told them more of her story.
My daughter and I were sitting in the living room watching TV. This was last month, before I sent her away to New York to live with her father. And you remember how cold it was, maybe 10 degrees. Suddenly, Maurice walked by in his jeans and undershirt, heading out the front door. I called out to him that it was too cold, but he kept on going, right out the door. My daughter ran back into her room to get her coat. She was going to catch him. But when she passed the door to our bedroom, I heard her scream, so I ran up there too. There was Maurice, sitting on the bed, putting on his shoes.
Nancy insisted. There was no possibility Maurice could have doubled back down the hall. She hadn't removed her eyes from the front door. Besides, only seconds had elapsed. Maurice was as bewildered by the incident as Nancy was. He insisted he hadn't gone near the living room or the front door, but was just getting ready to go out. The two policemen questioned Nancy repeatedly, and although skeptical of her account, were convinced she was sincere. Turning to Maurice, Kearns felt nausea welling up inside. Blood was still seeping from Maurice's eyes. He stared at the trooper with a grotesque leer. Kearns nearly knocked over a jar of instant coffee that was sitting at his elbow. "Jesus Christ!" the startled cop shouted. He watched, horrified, as Maurice's expression turned to one of demented fury. "What the hell do we do, Jerry?" asked the shaken Kearns. Siebert had been wondering the same thing, but he had an idea. He had seen enough. "We're going to call Father Beardsley." On the other side of Warren, Father Galen Beardsley, a rotund, elderly parish priest, was eating his lunch, a tuna sandwich, a pickle and chips, and a cup of milk. Beardsley had been pastor of St. Paul's in Warren for 5 years and was nearing retirement age. He already had his mobile home down at the trailer park and was dreaming of the day he would move into it. When the telephone rang, he gazed regretfully at his tuna sandwich, and a flash of apprehension went through him. Father Beardsley had a premonition that the phone call had something to do with Frenchy Ferriol, and unlike the local police chief, the priest was certain Frenchy's problems were genuine. He had already been out to the Ferriol home on more than one occasion and blessed the house. But he had seen enough in those visits to know that whatever was going on was more than he was equipped to handle. The parish priest who had preceded him in his post had been called out one night to visit the home of a man who claimed to be possessed by demons. According to the local records, the man had tried to kill the priest when he first visited. With holy water and prayers, the man's bizarre behavior had ceased. But it was too late for the priest. He died shortly afterward, at the young age of 55. That's why, a few weeks earlier, Father Beardsley had called in a pair of demonologists, Ed and Lorraine Warren, to investigate what was going on with Frenchy Ferriol. So as the phone rang, he thought it might be the Warrens calling. They had promised to come up to Warren again over the weekend to continue their investigation of the phenomena that had been plaguing Frenchy Ferriol. Father Beardsley picked up the phone and listened intently for several minutes as Siebert recounted the morning's events. "Chief," said the priest, taking a deep breath, "there's nothing you can do. This thing is bigger than you. In fact, it's bigger than both of us. But there are some people who are trying to help. Their names are Ed and Lorraine Warren. They're demonologists. They're already familiar with what's been going on. In fact, they've been up here a couple of times." "Oh," said Siebert. "They're supposed to come back again soon," Father Beardsley said. "They're trying to decide if Frenchy needs an exorcism. I think I'll call them again right now and see if they can come up here tonight. I don't know if we can wait any longer." "That's for sure," said the stunned Siebert. "Somebody's got to do something soon." After hanging up, Beardsley gazed out of the rectory window for several minutes. Then he reached for his Rolodex, flipping through it until he came to the W's. When he found the number for the Warrens, he slowly reached for the phone and dialed the number in Connecticut. As he dialed, he thought about what Chief Siebert had told him. It seemed as if things were getting worse for Frenchy. He hoped that the Warrens could get back up here quickly. The situation was definitely out of control. As he listened to the ring of the phone, Father Beardsley looked up at the crucifix above his desk. "We're going to need your help on this one, Lord," he whispered. 2.
Fall in Maine. The leaves turn from green to a patchwork of colors. The trees explode into a canvas of brilliant hues, red, then orange, yellow, gold, and finally brown, before they drop to the ground. 10-year-old Maurice Theriault was trudging through the fallen leaves that had gathered along the side of St. John Road on his way home from school. There was a pleasing scent of burning leaves in the cold air. Maurice's cheeks were ruddy and his nose was runny. He was small for his age, but muscular. Perhaps it was the line of his jaw that made him seem older, or his tired eyes. His neck and shoulders were well developed from working in the potato fields and the barn for as long as he could remember. He always wore the same blue plaid shirt and jeans, which his mother carefully patched and repatched at the elbows and knees. Poverty was a way of life among the farmers in tiny Van Buren, Maine, in 1946. Located directly on the Canadian border in rural Aroostook County, Van Buren, population 4,500, was home to many of Maine's potato farms. Even in the midst of post-war prosperity, life was hard for those who had to scratch a living out of Maine's rocky soil. St. John Road ran alongside the St. John River and eventually connected to Main Street, the heart of what passed for downtown in tiny Van Buren. As he walked, Maurice spotted a group of boys playing in a pile of leaves in a field where the road bent. He quickened his pace, secretly wishing he could join them, but hoping they wouldn't see him. Sometimes, some of the other boys made fun of him when they spotted him coming, because he usually stank of cow dung. They teased him unmercifully, and he hated it. Even though the other kids also lived on farms, their fathers let them enjoy their childhoods. Maurice didn't have that luxury. Their lives seemed so different from his. For one thing, most of the boys his age were in higher grades. They didn't have to miss school as often as he did in order to help their fathers out on their farms. Of course they had chores to do, but the other boys weren't expected to do nearly as much as Maurice had to do. It hurt Maurice to be different, and he felt like an outcast. He continued to walk home as he usually did, head down, looking at the pavement. As he walked, Maurice thought back to the day the previous spring when his father had bought a new tractor. "Drive it or else," his father had threatened. The child tried his best, but couldn't master what was really a man's job. His little legs couldn't reach the pedals. Short legs were no excuse, as far as Philip Theriault was concerned. He was determined that Maurice would work as a full-fledged farmhand. When his son failed in a task, even one a grown man might find difficult, Philip would respond with a stinging smack in the face or a humiliating kick in the behind. Philip Theriault didn't have a loving bone in his body. He towered over Maurice, his menacing presence much taller than his actual 5'9". His mouth was a permanent scowl, formed by the deeply etched lines from his nose. His thick, wire-rimmed glasses made his eyes a tiny blur. The few times Maurice saw his father without his glasses, he seemed almost human. It was a cruel illusion. Philip would just as soon slap Maurice as say hello to him. For Maurice, there were no fatherly hugs or pats on the back. Philip had little use for his other children either, but Maurice, as the eldest, bore the brunt of his abuse. By the time he was 10, Maurice already had 9 brothers and sisters. Eventually, there would be 15 children in all. But there was no even division of labor or abuse around the Theriault farm. Maurice was followed by 3 girls, Jean, Pam, and Sue. But because they were girls, Philip didn't expect them to help out much, especially with the hard chores. He pretty much ignored them. After the 3 girls came Philip Jr., called Phil. He was Philip's pet. Whatever affection Philip could muster went to Phil. Then came Betty, Judy, and Anne. Philip ignored them, as he did the other girls. 7 more children would eventually follow, but none would ever get the treatment that Philip had reserved for his firstborn.
even as a toddler in St. Agathe, where the Theriols had lived before Philip purchased the farm in Van Buren, Maurice hid under his bed, hoping his father wouldn't find him and hit him. At first, Maurice just feared his father. Before long, he hated him with a burning passion. But as much as he hated the cold-hearted farmer, Maurice would not think of disobeying his father's commands. If he did, he knew to expect a blow, from the back of his father's hand, his fist, or even a 2x4 if that was nearby. If he was late coming home today, he thought as he hurried, head down, past the children frolicking in the leaves, he shuddered to think what his punishment would be. It was harvest season, and Philip had a full afternoon's work planned for Maurice. One quick look at the boys jumping in the leaves, and Maurice speeded up his pace for home. When he reached the weathered brown farmhouse, little Maurice looked for his mother, hoping she might be in the kitchen, baking some of the French-Canadian pastries that he loved so much. Alice Theriol was a short, slender woman, with a long brown braid down her back that was turning frosty gray at her crown. Her round brown eyes and oval-shaped face reminded Maurice of an angel he had seen on a stained glass window in church. He thought of it whenever he saw her hair unwound from its braid. Maurice marveled at how neat and clean she looked, despite the hours of drudgery in the farmhouse and the even more grueling days out in the fields. But her hands were rough and calloused. The nails were short and the knuckles were reddened, swollen from hours of pounding a washboard, doing laundry by hand for her large family. Since his brothers and sisters were too young to stand up to Philip, Alice was the only person on earth Maurice could turn to for help. She tried to protect him from Philip's rage, often standing between them and taking a blow herself. Maurice wished he could stop that from happening, but it was impossible. All he could do was weep for his mother. But they never discussed his father's violence. Never. To his disappointment, his mother was not in the kitchen when he arrived home. Most likely she was out in the field, picking potatoes, following Philip's orders. Gulping down a glass of milk, Maurice went looking for his father. He wasn't aware of the milk mustache left on his upper lip. Better not to dawdle and incur Philip's wrath. Maurice looked downhill toward the barn and saw his father entering it. Probably going to fix a piece of machinery or tend to a sick animal, Maurice thought. The boy wanted to watch, hoping he could learn something useful. But he also knew that if he asked his father to teach him, his reward would be a curse or a beating. Maurice decided to slip into the barn and secretly watch from behind a bale of hay. Maybe if he learned something on his own, his father would be pleased. The boy took his time walking to the barn, trying to drum up enough courage to spy on his father. He tried to anticipate his father's unpredictable rages, and in his head, he continually heard Philip's booming voice screaming at him. No matter what the circumstances, Maurice just couldn't win. When Maurice reached the barn door, he grabbed the old iron handle and pulled quietly. The familiar warmth of the barn and its smell enveloped him as he slipped inside. The light from outside poured into the barn and seemed to shine like a spotlight into one of the stalls. He heard some shuffling in the hay. When he saw what his father was doing, his jaw dropped and his eyes opened wide. The boy wasn't quite sure what was going on, but he knew he shouldn't be there. He tried to run, but he was frozen, as in a nightmare. A hot flash raced through him as he imagined himself being spotted. Maurice wondered if he should stay put or get out of there as quickly as possible. He pondered the alternatives for a moment, gulped, and made his decision. Turning to sneak out, Maurice didn't see the black pitchfork that had been leaning against the bale of hay. He only brushed against it, but that was enough to send it clanking noisily to the ground. The sound startled Philip, who immediately stopped what he'd been doing and looked around. His eyes locked on Maurice, and the boy froze with panic. "Maurice." Philip's voice sounded like thunder, Maurice trembled.
Yes, Papa.
He could hardly get the words out of his mouth. Maurice, come here. The boy hesitated. Maurice, come here, or I will kill you, Philip said, his eyes still riveted on his frightened son. Maurice walked slowly toward the stall. I want you to watch me, Philip said, resuming what he had been doing before he was interrupted. Maurice could hardly bear to watch, but he didn't dare look away. A few minutes later, Philip was finished. Maurice turned, poised to run, but his father's voice held him in place. Now, do what I was doing, his father commanded. Maurice closed his eyes and tried to imitate his father, all the while wishing he were anywhere else. After a few minutes, Philip told him to stop. If you're going to watch me, then you're going to have to do what I do, he said. Next time, maybe you won't watch me, and you better not say a word to anybody about this. If you do, you'll die, and I'll bury you in a manure pit. With that, Philip strode out of the barn, bellowing a depraved laugh. Maurice began to cry, not sure what it was that he had just done, but understanding that it was somehow evil. What he didn't know, couldn't have known, was that with this act, he had opened the door to a lifetime of torment, and that the perpetrator of that torment would make Philip seem like a pussycat. Maurice kept his terrible secret for 3 years. During that time, Philip continued his forays into the barn and often forced Maurice to join him. Maurice knew what he was doing was sick and terrible, and he hated himself for doing it. He always felt an evil presence in that barn. Maurice was growing up sullen and introspective. His posture was changing. His once erect frame was now stooped, and his head was bowed from continually looking at the ground. Only with his mother did Maurice feel safe, but he was betraying her by keeping his terrible secret, and he felt overwhelmed by guilt. He thought of confessing his sin to Father Maynard, but he was too ashamed, even in the dark privacy of the confessional. He felt too ashamed to even look at the cross. His mother asked him several times what his father did in the barn, but Maurice couldn't bring himself to tell her either. The boy did his best to hide his torment, but inside he imagined he was already in hell. One day he was enjoying a piece of fresh apple pie with his mother in the security of her kitchen, when he decided to be brave. Mama, the boy whispered. You know how you're always asking me what Papa is doing when he goes to the barn? If you want to know, why don't you watch? That was as close as he could come to telling her. Alice Theriault knew that her 13-year-old son was troubled, but rather than press him, she decided to act on his suggestion. She dreaded what she might discover. Worse, she dreaded that Philip might find out she was spying on him. That would mean a certain beating. But she had to discover her husband's secret. Maurice waited upstairs in his room as his mother headed for the barn. He was so apprehensive he could hardly breathe. Please, God, he prayed. Don't let her get caught. He opened the window and breathed as silently as he could in order to hear better. He sank to his knees and recited the Lord's Prayer. His knuckles turned white from being squeezed so hard. Before he could finish, he heard his father's voice, and he knew the worst had happened. You bitch! You fucking bitch! What the hell do you think you're doing in here? Maurice heard a sharp crack, then a scream.
Oh, God! Oh, God, I hope she's all right, the boy prayed as a chill went up and down his spine.
I'm going to kill you someday, woman, he heard his father scream. I swear I'm going to kill you someday.
Maurice sobbed. There was something in his father's voice that made him sure it was more than just an idle threat. But Maurice didn't have time just then to dwell on the threat on his mother's life. The barn door burst open, and Philip was already on his way to the farmhouse to hunt for him.
Maurice, tu vas payer pour ça. You're going to pay for this.
Maurice thought about running and hiding, but where would he go? Philip would find him and beat him even worse. The door burst open. Philip stood there bare-chested in his dirty work pants, his hair a mess. The veins in his face seemed as though they would burst, and his eyes seemed to pop through those thick glasses.
You little bastard, he screamed. I told you not to tell her.
I didn't tell her, Papa, Maurice whimpered. Ask her if you don't believe me.
But Philip didn't even hear Maurice's answer. He had pulled his belt out of its loops and was already waving the strap around like a madman. A strange gurgle was coming from his throat. Philip attacked his son furiously, whipping him repeatedly all over his body. The razor-sharp belt sang through the air with each blow, drawing blood as Maurice curled into a ball and cowered under the assault. By the time he had stopped, Philip's belt was dripping with blood. He wiped it off on Maurice's quilted bedspread and put it back on before heading downstairs. Maurice lay on his bed, sobbing, aching with pain. He cried from his gut and wondered why he'd ever been born. He cried until there were no more tears, until he had no more strength. He stayed in a fetal position for hours, staring at a bloodstain that Philip's strapping had left on his bedspread. I hate him. I hate him. I hate him, he thought. I've got to get out of here. Maurice's thoughts drifted back to a frigid February afternoon, 7 years earlier. He was walking home from school in a raging blizzard that started at 11 a.m. Most of the other children had been picked up by their fathers that day, but 6-year-old Maurice was left to fend for himself, as usual. The howling wind and snow cut into his face. He pulled his hat down over his ears and wrapped his scarf across his mouth, but he couldn't escape the bitter cold. He could hardly see in front of him. Snow was swirling madly, and the landscape was quickly turning white. His face stung, and his fingers and toes were going numb. The snow piled up fast. By the time Maurice was halfway home, it was up to his knees. To escape the biting wind, he took cover behind a snowbank that must have been 5 feet high. He crouched down to keep warm, and within minutes he was covered with snow. He began to cry. Unable to move his arms or legs, he slipped toward unconsciousness. Maurice no longer felt the cold. Everything was white. Then, the face of a man appeared. He had long brown hair, a neat brown beard, and soft, warm eyes. Instead of a plaid woodsman's jacket or a down vest, he wore only a white robe. The man looked at Maurice and smiled. Despite the freezing weather, the man didn't appear cold at all. In fact, he seemed to radiate warmth. Leaning over, the man extended his hands. He picked Maurice up almost without effort and began carrying him away. The man never said a word to Maurice. The next thing the boy knew, he was home in bed. His mother fed him a bowl of hot soup and told him that he had somehow appeared safely on the porch of the farmhouse.
It was Jesus who saved me, Mama, Maurice said.
Alice Theriault had not seen the man who had dropped her son off at her doorstep in the middle of the raging blizzard. But she had no doubt that Jesus was responsible. When she had seen how bad the storm was, she'd said a prayer, asking God's protection for her son on his way home from school. Jesus had answered her prayer by having one of the townspeople give her son a ride home. She was certain. I'm sure he did, Maurice, she said. I'm sure he did. Once Maurice had snapped out of his daydream, his tears had dried and his anger subsided. Just remembering that day had calmed him down. Perhaps Jesus would come and save him again. By the next spring, things had only gotten worse around the Theriol farm. It was planting season, and Maurice was being made to work harder than ever. Whenever it was planting or harvest time, he'd be forced to quit going to school for weeks at a time. As a result, he was far behind in his studies. Although he was 13, he was only in third grade. Some of his younger sisters, who weren't forced to work around the farm as if they were adults, had already passed him in school. Maurice wasn't stupid, but everybody treated him as if he were. When Philip did allow him to attend school, he'd still have to work each afternoon after classes and all day on weekends. Even though the other kids picked on him at school, it was better than staying home to work with his father. Working alongside his father meant being yelled at for the smallest mistake and being slapped or kicked. Philip Theriol hated his own existence and took it out on everyone, especially his eldest son. Maurice got to the point where he'd do anything rather than work with his father. One day, Maurice was having trouble starting the tractor when his father exploded at him.
"Maurice, you no good bastard! Can't you even start the machine?"
"I'm sorry, Papa. It must be broken. I'm doing it the way I usually do it."
Philip charged at his son, huffing and snorting like a bull. He jumped up onto the tractor and pushed him as hard as he could with both hands, knocking the boy off his seat and onto the ground. Maurice fell with a thud, his head landing against a boulder. He got up slowly and began walking, dazed, toward the farmhouse, trying to stop the bleeding by holding his t-shirt tight against the gash in his scalp. Philip took no notice. He had gotten the tractor started and was already driving away toward the potato field. As he stumbled toward the farmhouse, Maurice's hatred for his father consumed him. He turned around and looked at Philip disappearing into the distance.
"I'd rather work for the devil than work for you," the boy shouted.
He felt a little better when he said it, so he said it again, this time louder.
"I'd rather work for the devil than for you."
Maurice repeated it loudly, over and over again, as he neared the house. In the kitchen, Alice had just taken a strawberry rhubarb pie out of the oven and was putting it on the windowsill to cool. Maurice's voice was ringing out across the yard.
"I'd rather work for the devil than for you."
Alice shuddered when she overheard her son's sacrilegious oath. Somewhere, someone else was listening too. 3. The following day, Philip thumped up the stairs and barged into Maurice's bedroom, well before daylight. Snapping on the ceiling light, he barked,
"Let's go, Maurice, now! We've got some fields to plow!"
Maurice groaned from under his pillow.
"Can't I sleep a little longer, Papa?"
The sudden flood of light was painful for Maurice's sleepy eyes. Waking was always a disappointment, because his dreams, when he could remember them, were so much more pleasant than real life. Sometimes he would try to retain the plots of his dreams and elaborate on them during the day. This particular morning, he was dreaming about kissing a girl from school when the rude interruption came.
"I guess you didn't hear me, you lazy bastard. I said get out of bed, now."
Philip started to take out his strap, but Maurice was already out of bed, had pulled on his jeans, and was on his way downstairs to the kitchen. He gulped down a glass of milk, grabbed a croissant, and headed out the door toward the tractor.
"Maurice, you start up the tractor, and today I want you to do it right."
The boy grimaced. He dreaded what would happen if he failed again. He walked slowly toward the intimidating machine, going over in his mind the proper way to start it. The seat squeaked as he climbed into it. He extended his left leg as far down as he could, using every ounce of strength he could muster to push the clutch to the floor. Then he turned the key and quickly put the gas pedal to the floor, while lifting his left leg off the clutch. This was where he usually got into trouble. He just couldn't seem to do all those things in a fluid sequence, so that the machine would go forward without stalling. But this time he had no trouble at all. Somehow his legs seemed longer. He hardly had to strain to keep the clutch down, and when it came time to hit the gas and let go of the clutch, he did it easily. The tractor lurched slightly, then moved forward without a hitch, almost as if it were moving on its own. This is easy, Maurice thought to himself, steering the tractor downhill toward the main potato field. The motion of the big tires over the rows of spring mud jostled his head and shoulders in syncopation with the motor. The sweet spring air, coupled with this new accomplishment, made Maurice feel heady. He felt older. Maurice never had trouble starting the tractor again, and plowing the fields was no longer the torture that it had always been. Maurice couldn't figure it out. It seemed almost as though somebody were next to him, helping him do the work. It was an easy spring. By fall, he was running the tractor like a man. He harvested so many potatoes that even Philip had trouble finding fault with him, although he certainly tried. One day in late October, Philip and Maurice were boxing potatoes, and Philip actually warned his son that he was working too hard. But it wasn't Maurice's welfare he was looking out for.
"Maurice, you're going too fast," Philip said over his shoulder. "Take it easy. I don't want you to wear out now. We're just about finished harvesting. Next week we start hauling logs. You'll need all your strength for that."
Philip was glad his son was now doing the work of a man, yet it bothered him to see the boy growing up. It might not be so easy to push him around anymore. "Ah, what am I worrying about?" he thought. "The kid's only 14. I'm still in charge around here. And besides, I'll use his strength for hauling." Every winter, between harvest and planting seasons, Philip hauled logs to help make ends meet. It was the job Maurice dreaded most. The logs were so heavy that grown men often had trouble lifting them. And it was usually so cold that a few hours of work would leave his fingers numb and his neck sore and stiff, so that lifting the logs became twice as difficult. One December morning, Philip and Maurice were getting ready to haul a pile of logs to Paul Corsi's farm across town. The temperature had dropped to zero, and the snow was falling hard. Maurice was reaching for the snow chains.
"Papa, they say we're going to have a blizzard," he said. "Maybe we should wait until the storm is over."
Philip glared at his son.
"That just shows how stupid you are," he shouted, curling his lip with disgust and shaking his finger at him. "If there's a storm, Paul's going to need his logs, isn't he? Now start loading these fucking logs on the flatbed, and don't question me again."
It was the coldest day of the year so far. Maurice placed his hands against the